Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
By now, you've probably seen the video, or at least a little of it, of the University of California at Davis police officer calmly, almost casually, pepper spraying a row of seated, nonviolent, doing nothing, Occupy protesters. You just heard a few seconds of screaming as the spraying occurs. It happened Friday and has been bouncing around social media. If you haven't seen this unbelievable 8-minute video, you can watch it on our show page. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show. And James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, as well as other writers at their website, have been thinking and writing really insightfully about the incident all weekend, including how perhaps the most remarkable part of the incident as captured on video was not the cold, calculated pepper spraying itself, but the restraint of the protesters for minutes after that, and how they chased away the police, literally, with nonviolent chanting. So with that as backdrop, in case you haven't seen this video, James Fallows, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Nice to talk with you.
And you raise a comparison with the civil rights protesters being fire hosed in the early 1960s. Tell us in your own words what it made you think of.
So obviously there are huge differences in scale and long-term historic sweep between the civil rights movement, which had been a century in gestation by the 1960s, and whatever is happening now to reflect the tensions over the inequalities in American society. But as a matter of imagery, there was this arresting moment of this UC Davis policeman just sauntering along and spraying people, which visually and I think in a kind of moral, emotional way brought to my mind, at least immediately, the pictures of civil rights protesters in the 1960s being fire hosed by Bull Connor's policemen in Birmingham. And again, the whole stakes were different, but the sense of the moral content of an image seemed very similar. And you could see which group was braver, which group you immediately empathized with, which seemed to be acting on a kind of principle. And I think that the remarkable discipline of the protesters, at least at Davis and at most of these other Occupy showdowns too, is having a cumulative effect, because the police in general are overreacting, and the occupiers in general are controlling themselves while coming under attack, and that has an effect.
I don't know if, as a matter of politics, most Americans aren't more seeing Oakland or more seeing some of the dirt and grime around Occupy in New York, and that's having the lasting impact, and people tend to give the benefit of the doubt toward the police. That's a political question, but in this case, toward the end of the incident, we're going to play another clip, because the protesters are basically surrounding the police, even as the police are surrounding the small group who they pepper sprayed as they were seated. And you think, well, anything could happen here. These angry college students could get violent and start attacking the police. The police even have weapons trained on them. But there's this moment where the protesters, after chanting, "Shame on you, shame on you," and some other things like that, they literally give the police permission to leave. It's some strange dance between trying to order them to leave, even though they're just standing there unarmed and the police are training rifles at them. They're ordering the police to leave, and they're giving permission to the police to leave. It is really an amazing turnaround. We'll see what people can make of the audio of this without the video. This is 40 seconds.
We are willing! We are willing to give you a brief moment!
To give you a brief moment!
Please! Please! You may take your weapons!
You can go. We will not follow you, using the human microphone technique of the Occupy gatherings. And James Fallows, remarkably, the police went. They turned around in a group and they left.
It is an incredible drama played out over 8 minutes. And as most of the initial attention was on the first 30 or 40 seconds when the pepper spraying occurs. But then, as you say, as it goes on and the students, protesters control themselves and essentially sort of back the police, it looks as if they are shaming the police into leaving or whatever the police are deciding about going out. The person I also thought of while watching these films is a military theorist named John Boyd. He died maybe 10 or 15 years ago. He was a great theorist of the patterns of conflict, and he emphasized always that any kind of competition was finally a competition of ideas and moral standing, as opposed to just of plain force. And while the Occupy movement has in many ways annoyed people in the ways you've been saying, if you're going right by the site in New York or other places, you see some of the ways in which they've not been considerate of the long-term battle of ideas. But these showdowns with the police have in many, many cities won the movement a legitimacy that it could hardly have won for itself because of the overreaction and the difference in behavior between the two sides.
On the other hand, is Occupy losing control of its narrative? Does it risk becoming – Chris Matthews was just here talking about, what Occupy says that everybody kind of identifies with, which is that Wall Street has too much control over the government. And people on the right agree with that. People on the left agree with that. But does Occupy risk becoming a protest or about police and risk losing track of the focus on income inequality?
I'm sure that's so, and I'm sure it's so because of one of the more unusual aspects of this phenomenon, which there's no one centrally in charge. It's unlike the civil rights movement of 40 years ago in that way, or the Vietnam protest movement of 40 years ago. There is much more of a bottoms-up nature to it with the strengths and weaknesses that brings. And I don't know about you, Brian, but my sense is this is the first thing in a long time where I don't really know where it might lead. Because the underlying concerns that I think are being reflected or being tapped by this movement are so great, and yet the uncertainty about where it will go is also so profound that I just don't know what a month from now or 6 months from now we might be saying about the political and social impact of what's started so far.
Which takes it outside of itself. And in one of your pieces on the incident, as you've been posting all weekend, you wrote that if we saw this coming from some riot control unit in China or Syria, we'd think this is what happens when authority is unaccountable and has lost any sense of human connection to a subject population. That's what I think you wrote here. Is that a fair connection? And obviously, maybe the biggest story in the world today is what's going on in Cairo with the military reaction to the protests there. But I don't want to draw any facile comparisons.
Sure. And obviously, what is happening in Syria and Egypt, in Syria over the last couple of weeks, Egypt the last couple of days of shooting protesters is quite different from this. But just a few minutes ago, just before I came on the air with you, I got a message from a friend who is an American teaching in Chengdu, China. And he said how humiliating it was for him to be watching this the Davis scene in China and not recognizing initially that it was from America. And then this is getting huge play on the Chinese media saying these are the Americans, their kind of brutality. Of course, that's hypocritical for the Chinese, but still, it is something we don't want to think that a society of laws, this is the way that police citizen interactions occur here.
And to that point, and we'll end with this, your colleague at The Atlantic, Ta-Nehisi Coates, wrote a post effectively saying, he doesn't want to diminish the terribleness of what happened at UC Davis, but welcome to the world of police overreaction, white people.
Of course, and indeed. And that's part of the potential of this moment in our cultural history, that it is providing the spark and the focus for just a lot of discussions that we should have been having for a long time. So I agree with him about that, and it's fascinating to see people bringing their complementary different perspectives to bear on this phenomenon.
James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Thank you for thinking about this and writing about it and talking about it here.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, coming up in a minute, we get to a situation so serious that it has to do with children being abducted and forced to go to war. And we have a rare opportunity to speak with a guest from Uganda who is here in New York raising awareness about that issue. And he has got some story to tell, so stay tuned.